On this episode of Newt's World, the Heritage Foundation released a new comprehensive report this week that details the dual crisis for boys and men in America, entitled Men Without Meaning, The Harmful Effects of Expressive Individualism. Here to discuss the report, I'm really pleased to welcome my guest, Brenda Hafera. She is the Assistant Director and Senior Policy Analyst for the Simon Center for American Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Brenda, welcome, and thank you for joining me on Newt's World.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start at the beginning. What is the boy crisis?
The boy crisis is answering a question, which is how and why are boys and men in America and sometimes around the world struggling to flourish? And it turns out that this is mental, physical, economic, academic, and spiritual. So, for example, the second leading cause of death for men under 45 in the United States is suicide. The IQ of our boys are actually dropping. And in 2020, only 25% of men ages 17 to 24 qualified for military service because of mental, physical, and drug abuse or a combination of those factors. 41% of our girls are proficient in writing, which is not good, but only 20% of our boys are proficient in writing. And men now earn approximately 40% of college degrees at a time when the earnings for folks with just a high school diploma is dropping. And then over 7 million men between the ages of 25 and 55 have entirely checked out of the workforce. So it's far-reaching, and there are a lot of examples of why millions of men and boys are struggling.
If there are 7 million men between 25 and 55 who've checked out of the workforce, what are they doing?
They're not spending their time, for the most part, looking after children or doing very good things. So on average, they're spending about 5.5 hours watching television and movies. So a lot of the time is being spent in front of screens. About half of these men are on medication. There's a lot of drug abuse going on. And it feels like they're just kind of listless and don't have a lot of purpose and a direction in their life.
How much does the rise of the gaming culture a part of that?
I think it's certainly part of that. So video games are part of that screen time. And video games are becoming more addictive as they're being developed. So a lot of these men are indeed spending time in front of video games.
In your report, you say that the single direct driver of the boy crisis is the absence of fathers. What's the evidence for that?
That's right. So there's a lot of evidence. So according to Will Ferrell and John Gray's book, The Boy Crisis, the absence of fathers or his presence impacts school achievement, verbal intelligence and quantitative abilities, school dropouts, employment, suicide, drugs, homelessness, bullying, victimization, violent crime, rape, poverty and mobility, hypertension, trust, and empathy. So it's a lot of causes there and a lot of effects. And as an example, telomeres, which develop early in life and predict the lifespan of children, children with father loss have by age 9 telomeres that are 14% shorter, and that effect is 40% greater for boys compared to girls. So the lack of fathers, about half of kids today grow up in two-parent households, half of them don't. The lack of fathers is really the primary driver behind the boy crisis.
Does that also then lead to dramatically greater criminal behavior?
Yes, it certainly does. So strikingly, in Brad Wilcox's book, he points out that young men without both parents are more likely to go to prison than to graduate from college.
So this has all happened despite, in some ways, the best intentions of those who created the welfare state. Has the welfare state actually been an assistant to the decline of males?
It certainly has. So much of this is driven by the absence of fathers, which is, of course, tied to the breakdown of the family or the lack of family formation. So the welfare state, which developed in the 60s, some of those policies were actually only given to single moms. And this created, for a time, the phenomenon of fathers actually leaving the home or not being in the home so that moms could get assistance with their children. And because of that, that caused marriage rates to decline and caused even more of a breakdown of the family. And we know that parents that live together but don't get married, those relationships are much less stable than parents that do get married. So the breakdown of the family was caused by the welfare state. That was an impetus. And at this point, it's actually become the norm, especially for the lower class and for the poor. They're not getting married at all. So it's just become the way that things are done, which was precipitated by the welfare state.
In some ways, I was really first bought into this by Losing Ground by Charles Murray, where he pointed out that the actual effect of welfare had been to break up the family, to reduce the chances of getting out of poverty, and to create habits which almost guaranteed you would stay in poverty. And I thought that Murray's book was a major factor in how we design welfare reform, which was designed to get parents back to work and to get children back into an environment where work was a norm. The other big impact for us was Marvin Olasky's The Tragedy of American Compassion, where Olasky argues that bureaucratic compassion and the transfer of money to the poor were exactly what the classic 19th century reformers hated, because it basically made it easier to stay poor, and as a result guaranteed an increase in poverty behavior and an increase in the culture of poverty. I mean, does that fit what your studies have indicated?
Yes. So welfare reform in the 90s happened and it tied welfare to work. And we actually saw after that happened that the decline in marriage started to level off, right? It had been just devastating to marriage rates. And it creates intergenerational cycles of poverty. If the success sequence, which is get at least a high school diploma, get a job, get married, and then have children. The success sequence, if you do that, you have about a 3% chance of ending up in poverty. So it's a really powerful tool.
In a funny way, though, our policies have been anti-marriage in that we've said in order to get the subsidy, you have to be living by yourself. On the other hand, it's been pretty hard to argue, unless you go to a guaranteed income, it's hard to try to figure out how you design a program which both provides resources and discriminates in favor of marriage rather than against it.
Right, I agree. And there are still marriage penalties on the books, especially for the lower class, ironically for the poor, when it comes to health care. And so we did eliminate some of those marriage penalties for the middle class and for the upper class, but we haven't for the poor.
All of this, it seems to me, and I think your study indicates, is compounded by the education system's impact on young males. Can you describe some of how the education system has an unintended consequence in dealing with young males?
Right. So the primary driver is the absence of fathers, but I think education system contributes its fair share. So some of these trends are long-term, and some of these trends are short-term. So we now spend more time in school, which has led to over-credentialing and the prioritization of academic standards over development standards, things like recess, things like free play, which are really important for children, both boys and girls, but boys as well. And the progressive style of education has really become to predominate in our schools. and we've shifted from a free-range parenting style to a safety culture. So boys now spend a lot of times in classrooms where they are forced to sit still for long periods of time. We've declined recess. We've implemented zero tolerance policies since the 90s, which were meant to be a reaction to the fear of school shooters. And those have punished some of the normal antics of boys. And we've seen, for example, that boys who commit the same behaviors as girls are actually punished more severely. So there may be some teachers who expect that boys and girls should behave exactly the same. And the classroom environment is just overall can be very challenging for boys because their prefrontal cortex takes 2 years longer to develop than it does for girls. So sometimes the behavior skills are a challenge and teachers tend to factor in good behavior to their grading.
You'd almost be better off to design a system for males and a system for females and recognize that they're going to be substantially different.
Right. So we do have studies. We know certain pedagogical techniques work better for boys. So free movement works better for boys. Competition tends to work better for boys. They need structure. They need discipline. And girls need many of these things too, but boys especially need them. And then boys tend to be interested sometimes in different books from girls. So they like hero stories. They tend to like nonfiction.
Brenda, what are the sort of things you think parents can do and what kind of schools should they be looking at in order to help young males?
I think the schools that show promise are classical schools right now and also Montessori schools. Classical schools are experiencing a resurgence since COVID, but I think a lot of parents are seeing this as well, that classical schools are particularly good for boys. So the things that need to be prioritized when educating boys, it's kinetic education, so free movement, free play. Nonfiction books, books about heroes are the ones that boys tend to like. Having a teacher that is actually likes boys. So since the sexual revolution and since the idea that boys and girls are the same, 3 out of 4 teachers are women and they've been educated in schools that promote gender ideology. So sometimes they expect the boys and girls to behave the same. And boys tend to respond also to competition.
In a sense, isn't that almost in direct conflict with the current fad that we're all the same?
Yes, this is a big part of it. Many of these challenges can be traceable to the sexual revolution. And part of the sexual revolution was Simone de Beauvoir put forth the notion that sex and gender can be separated from one another and that it's not tied to biology, that the differences between men and women are a result of social norms. And this underlies so much of what has happened to young men and boys. Because once we think that the sexes are the same, that means that mothers and fathers are interchangeable. And they're not. Both of them contribute in unique and essential ways to the raising of children. Once we accept that, we believe in the classroom that boys and girls should behave the same, and they don't. And some of the policies that we've implemented as a result of that have been particularly damaging for boys.
So in a sense, the effort to create a monosexual culture, if you will, ultimately is shaped by women and defined as an almost anti-male culture.
I would say the culture has not been good about holding up positive views of masculinity. So the first and most important role model that a boy has is, of course, his father. He learns how to be a good man by looking at the witness of that example and imitating it. But then we've undermined male role models in so many other areas. So the dolt dad has become such an obvious example in our culture in things like Everybody Loves Raymond, where the father is incompetent and unreliable. He can't do anything with the help of his wife. That's a view we hold up. And then there's the toxic masculinity narrative, which tells boys that testosterone is basically a poison and doesn't encourage them to grow up to be good men. They think that there's something wrong with them and they're not getting encouragement. And then we've undermined male mentorship programs as well, things like Boy Scouts and free movement in sports and those sorts of things. And those are really important, especially if dad is not around, because those provide chances for boys to get together and to see male role models and benefit from that guidance.
One of the things which is sobering you point out in the report is that there is an increasing tendency to sort of medicate young males into not showing male behavior. The use of Ritalin and other things that your report suggests that some drug rehabilitation centers, 30 to 50% of the adolescents are now basically being medicated. They're not learning how to live with reality. They're learning how to avoid it.
Right. I agree. And that's certainly true in our education system, where we've seen the diagnosis of ADHD and ADD spike. And so many of our boys, they're being put on Ritalin and these other drugs to ensure that they're calm and well-behaved in the classroom, instead of us revisiting the structure of the classroom and our pedagogical techniques in order to cater to boys.
How is all of this going to ultimately change marriage behavior if you end up with a dramatically higher percentage of women with advanced degrees and a much smaller pool of males with advanced degrees? What happens to the traditional classic bonding patterns in terms of leading to marriage?
I think we're already seeing the effects of that, and that marriage is declining and people are getting married later in life. So this really started to happen with millennials. Millennials, the disproportion between the education of men and boys, or men and women, and the income levels has really sharpened. So according to Gene Twenge, every single penny of the rise in young adults' income is due to women's income in the millennial generation. And this is challenging because women tend to be hypergamous, meaning they want someone who is equal or above them in educational attainment and income. So for example, women are 91% more likely to swipe right on Tinder when a man has a master's degree than when he has a bachelor's degree.
That would encourage cheating and always listing yourself as having a master's degree.
That's right. Everyone can have a master's degree when it's virtual, right?
Right.
That is actually happening as well in online dating. Online dating is very bad in many ways. Overall, the platforms, there are some differences, but they're not good, because they can encourage what you're talking about, narcissistic behavior. They can encourage lying, all those sorts of things. And then women tend to get a false view of men because they're looking at these men online who are doing all these sorts of terrible things and think that's what men are really like. So anonymity does not encourage good behavior. We've seen that in social media and online dating.
But your core point, which I think is really important and probably get us into a controversy, women in a sense are genetically biased in favor of finding somebody who has higher education, greater income, and in a sense can protect them and can help them, which goes directly against the whole desire for independence and for the modern woman who doesn't need any of these things. But in fact, if that's an underlying pattern, then the way we're operating now as a society is exactly counterintuitive. We're going to produce, and you already see this with African Americans, a huge number of people who are very talented and have good incomes who are female, with a much smaller pool of available males that they could possibly marry, given that bias.
Right. I think women want someone who's going to be a strong partner and is going to be a partner, not someone that they have to look after themselves. Right. We've seen this narrative. So when men are struggling, which they are academically, physically, mentally, spiritually, which we've talked about, women are without partners. And especially if they're financially stable, they have so many other opportunities. So they're looking at these men and saying, this man is not someone I want to marry, which has led to, especially in the lower classes, this phenomenon of women who are having children outside of marriage because they don't view the father of their children as a responsible and reliable partner. And so the sexes are tremendously interdependent. It's not just about finances. Men and women have things to learn from each other. And from that friendship and support, we love our fathers, our sons, our brothers. They contribute so much to our lives. And I think being grateful for a father's sacrifices and what he brings financially is true, but that's not all that fathers and husbands do for women. They contribute in so many more ways and contribute to human flourishing. So getting back to the narrative that women and men are interdependent, and especially when it comes to the raising of children, having both a mother and a father is essential.
In your report, the Heritage Foundation really has a whole series of very practical, positive steps that should be taken. Could you just walk us through the sort of key breakthroughs that you think would make us a much healthier country, in part by reintroducing males to pursuing life and being engaged and having a sense of self-esteem?
Right. So this, as you can imagine, since we've talked about the breadth of this problem, there needs to be comparable solutions that are going to be in a lot of different areas. But to name a few, the most important is to revitalize marriage and fatherhood, and to hold up fatherhood and having a family as actually fulfilling and such an important part of the purpose of life that men are searching for, not just men, but men and women. And this is particularly important because now so many of adults have come from broken homes themselves. And when that happens, those adults can have a negative view of marriage. They're not quite sure necessarily how to work through communication in a healthy manner because they miss that model of what a good marriage is. So we need to have more of a conversation about what the purpose of marriage is and what to prioritize when you're looking for a spouse. Another solution is school choice, of course, because it's really important for parents to be able to go to a school and evaluate a school and say, is this a good environment for my boy, for my specific boy? Are they prioritizing discipline? Are they allowing for competition and for recess? And do they have books on the curriculum that my child is going to be interested in? Then a third one would be to get away from the narrative that there's one track in life, which is to go to college, and to actually open up vocational schools and apprenticeship programs. Brad Wilcox indicates in his book that the Department of Education spends 79 times more on colleges and universities than vocational education in high schools and community college. And the economic opportunities for men with a high school diploma or less have shifted because of economic shifts. And so that's really a challenge. And then finally, I would say that we really need to prioritize embodied interactions. So get away from the screens, get towards free play and embodied play, get away from dating apps, and get in back to face-to-face interactions.
You're playing a major role in helping shape public policy, and you come at it from a very interesting background. What got you personally engaged in this kind of activity? I mean, what you're doing is very important for the whole country.
Well, thank you. I have written on feminism and critiqued that. And I started getting interested in this topic because once you're thinking about women, you have to think about men because we're so interdependent and you end up reading that literature as well. And I came across Warren Farrell's book, The Boy Crisis, and it's really eye-opening because the statistics are just staggering about the importance of fathers, and not enough talk is happening about this problem for how severe and how important it is. And you can miss it depending on your, perhaps your demographics, your stage in life, and maybe not see it for what it is. And once you start to see the economic shifts, the education shifts, the breakdown of the family and how far reaching it is, we need to be doing more work to try and combat this devastating effects.
You've worked at Heritage, but if I understand correctly, you also do some work at Hillsdale.
I was a James Madison Fellow with Hillsdale. It's a program for young public policy professionals.
Did you find that helpful?
I did find it helpful because you're having discussions with other folks in these areas and learning their perspectives and refining your ideas, right? That's what freedom of speech, that's what deliberation does. So it's always helpful to get in a room with some other smart people and sharpen your ideas.
We have somebody who came to us as an intern and now is with us as a policy person who came out of Hillsdale in Michigan. And we have another person who's with us who's now going to Hillsdale in Washington in their graduate program. It seems to be a very rigorous and very serious institution.
I would wholeheartedly agree. They are doing good and serious work at Hillsdale.
It's a nice counterpart to Heritage, which I've known Heritage since Fulner founded it. Its impact on the country has been really pretty profound on a whole range of policies.
Yes, I'm very grateful to be there. And it gives you also a sense of responsibility because we are doing good work. And if you work at Heritage, you are very privileged and have an obligation to try and help the country.
So in a sense, the next administration could develop a kind of male reinforcement strategy and have a series of initiatives designed to rebuild the self-sufficiency and the sense of direction and the sense of engagement among young males. And in a way, that may be an integral part of our anti-drug program, because having people having greater self-esteem, I suspect, will be correlated with less likely suicide and less likely drug abuse.
Absolutely. About 70% of the opioid overdoses were men. So this is certainly part of that issue. This is very much a cultural problem, and we need cultural solutions. But I do think there is room for public policy on these issues. And some of them are not new solutions. They're old solutions, things like school choice that we just haven't been able to implement. There are things like reinvigorating male-only spaces. So there is room for some public policy initiatives here.
I look forward to it, and I'm confident that Heritage will be providing some of the guidelines for those kind of policies for the next Congress and the next administration. Brenda, I want to thank you for joining me. Your new report, Men Without Meaning, The Harmful Effects of Expressive Individualism, is available at heritage.org, and we'll also have it featured on our podcast show page. And I really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through this very important, literally at the heart of who we are, conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to my guests, Brenda Hafera. You can read her new report, Men Without Meaning, The Harmful Effects of Expressive Individualism, on our show page at NewsWorld.com. NewsWorld is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying NewsWorld, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of NewsWorld can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at Gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.